Hi, this is Julia Golding. Are you looking for a way to find a gentle beginning to your life as a fantasy writer? Or maybe you're just wanting to brush up your existing skills, but you don't have time to come to a class? Well, we've devised for you the perfect beginner's course. You can find it on our website. The course is full of exciting chapters for you to take at your own pace, starting with packing your bag and setting out on an adventure. And over the course of the lessons, you'll learn to find a hero, gather allies, and get under your belt all the basic skills you'll need to write yourself your fantasy story. So why not have a look at this today and see if it suits you? And I look forward to meeting you in our chat room, which comes along with the course. So what are you waiting for? Time to pack your bag and get writing. Hello and welcome to Mythmakers. Mythmakers is the podcast for fantasy fans and fantasy creatives, brought to you by the Oxford Centre for Fantasy. My name is Julia Golding. I'm an author and also I run the Centre for Fantasy. And today I'm joined by my regular podcast partner, Jacob Reneker, who is based in Seattle and is an expert on the making of fantasy games, amongst other things, and Tolkien. But I've since discovered he is also pretty much an expert on Percy Jackson. And that is the theme of today's podcast. So, Jacob, I first met Percy Jackson when my children were reading him. They're in their 20s now, so they were reading him as the books were first coming out. And I remember them absolutely adoring that series and really getting into it, particularly my oldest boy. We've got all of them on the shelf. Beautiful books. How long have you known about Percy Jackson?
Not nearly as long probably as your children have. So I really learned about them, got into them as an adult when I was graduate school, actually.
Yeah.
So it was more so
that, young at the moment. So you're in that in-between stage where you're waiting.
Exactly. Yeah. So it didn't come out when I was younger. So and largely my interest was because I was studying ancient mythology and cosmology. That's where the overlap was and kind of served as an introduction into this fantasy world in particular.
So we're going to talk about what makes a good adaptation, because there have been two bites at that particular cherry, at least. There was the film version of some time ago where they made, I think, did they make two or three of them? Two, wasn't it? They made two.
Two, yeah.
Two films. And Rick Riordan, the author, wasn't very happy with those adaptations. And now they've just made the Disney adaptation of Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief, which actually had Rick Riordan as part of the production team being behind that series. So let's start, first of all, with the more general things. What would you say makes for a good adaptation? What do we mean by good?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that's what is possibly the reason for some of the most heated disagreements between friends about was this a good adaptation, right? So everybody has a different idea of what good is. And it really, the challenge of adapting books in particular is that the level of audience engagement that's required. So you're having to paint all the pictures as a reader, especially if there hasn't been any sort of adaptation prior. You are casting the characters of the book yourself, right? You are creating settings, and now authors are painting the picture for you, but like you in your mind are really kind of creating all of the details. They're kind of providing canvas and these characters. They can describe them, but you are going to be casting them. So each person for each person, no two audience members book, like their idea of a book is going to be the same. It's not going to look the same because they're having to do that personal creation by reading, translating the written word into their imagination as they're reading it. So because of that, I think it's really hard to agree upon good adaptations, because good works of fiction are open to multiple interpretations. And so somebody might gravitate to this particular message or this particular theme or this particular character arc in a book because they identified it with it themselves. And so to see that character not treated with the same care that that person had while reading it, that's going to send them off the deep end when somebody cuts that character entirely out of an adaptation, or if they cast a character that was wildly different from the one that they imagined the character looking like in their head. So I think broadly speaking, understand that you can never get an adaptation that's going to make any person happy, completely happy, who's read the book. I think a good adaptation, talking about it from the book's perspective and perhaps the author's perspective, is one that does justice to the spirit and characters of the book. It's also ambiguous and open to interpretation.
Yeah, I suppose that's faithful to the book. So a good adaptation that's faithful to the book. And then there's an adaptation which manages to create its own form of artwork, which in a way exceeds or goes beyond what you thought the book would be. One area where I would say this, let's move sideways briefly. The Paddington films. If you read a straightforward Paddington novel, they're very sweet. But a Paddington film has gone one step further and made a kind of brilliant magical world around Paddington, and added all sorts of layers of characters and special effects, which make it even more charming than the original material. The original material is great in its own right, but they've gone above and beyond. So that's a delightful example of a place where I've never heard anyone saying, oh, that's a terrible adaptation of Paddington. No, everyone thinks, yeah, that's really good. You've done something more. So I think that's what you're looking for with an adaptation. You don't need something that's a straight version of the book. You want something which finds a new area in it. So, right, let's turn to Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief as a book, first of all. Let's think about it as a book. Yeah. Then we'll think about it as a film. And then we'll think about it as the television series. So firstly, as a book, I remember my children particularly liking how Rick Riordan had turned something which was seen as a disability, having ADHD, into something which was a secret superpower. So that was, first of all, a lovely sort of concept of reframing something that many children struggle with. And then they also loved the modernization. They already knew quite a few Greek myths, being the kind of family we were, which, you know, had probably already told them all this stuff, had, you know, storybooks about Greek myths. And they loved seeing the updating, the surprising appearance of the gods in modern life. So the playfulness. And I think they also enjoyed Percy Jackson himself as the main character. They don't like all books in that series equally, and the follow-on series, but the first one, they definitely, everybody liked. So that first book really works very well as a middle grade, upper end of middle grade, sort of slightly older children, reads very, very successful. And it's a book they read on their own. They didn't have it read to them. So it might be the kind of book which a young reader picks up for the first time and actually gets through themselves, because the storytelling and everything is so exciting that it is a really good book to click children onto reading. As an adult, I read them alongside my kids and really enjoyed them too. So how about you? What did you find in the books?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was actually turned off by the voice of the book, just initial gut reaction, because it is very, it's a middle grade audience, and the main character is a first person text, first person narrative, and they're, yeah, it's speaking like a middle grader. And that for whatever reason, it was really an obstacle for me to enjoy the book itself. So the messenger.
You were reading it as an adult, though.
I was reading it as as a graduate.
It's kind of, you got it.
So that's a different experience.
Yeah.
Right. So, but my nephew Connor, who has ADHD, knows it inside and out, absolutely loves it. And like that tone and the, you know, cheekiness of the character, of that first person character, like that, just like that drew him in, and connected with him. So I can see why people in that, you know, middle graders could really connect with the character and really enjoy that level of humor and like kind of commentary. And so for, yeah, so it is firmly in middle grade audience, middle grade setting, middle grade sensibilities, and does a really good job for that audience. So what was most intriguing to me and why I kind of stuck with it in spite of the kind of dissonance that created for me, not being a middle grader reading it, was the way that Reardon translated the Greek gods into contemporary United States settings and culture to a certain degree. So it was, yeah, so it was a translation of Greek myths, which that happens all the time, right? But this was very concrete by setting, you know, Olympus in New York at the top of the Empire State Building, right? So the specificity that it provided, you know, it created some fun connections and resonances that was just, yeah, that I hadn't seen done before in that way. And so that was fun to see, trying to figure out, okay, so where is he going to place this? Or so I was, yeah, instead of trying to anticipate, okay, so if I'm doing this, where is the greatest overlap between this character or this place and America as I know it? So it's like, so Neil Gaiman does this in American Gods to a certain degree. It's a different tack, but it's translating deities, this ancient stories, to contemporary life, culture, and what that means, what it looks like.
I can't think off the top of my head which came first. Was American Gods first? I think it was, wasn't it?
Well, that's a great.
Anyway, that's the Google, because you can imagine you reading that and then thinking, how would this work for children? That might be part of the sort of the compost out of which the idea grew. I would just point out here a couple of things for reading it as someone who isn't American, as a foreigner. We don't have in the UK the same culture of summer camps. So the summer camps were totally foreign. We don't send that, pack our kids off. It's too expensive. I don't know how anyone affords that. So Europeans tend to get more holiday. So you might have a play scheme locally, but you wouldn't send them off to a camp in the woods where they get up to death-defying things unless, you know, on not every summer, maybe occasionally. So there were sort of two levels of foreignness for an outsider. And the other thing is, there is a kind of American cultural supremacy that I kind of think, oh, what do the Greeks think?
Right.
I mean, maybe that's the language you'd use now and you wouldn't have in the 2000s, but culturally appropriating the Greek gods. So now thinking about it, I'm thinking, actually, oh, okay. I'm not sure.
It's problematic. Yeah. Watching the Percy Jackson series, I reread Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief, just so it was just like right on the top of my head. And that was one thing that I noticed that came up several times, was, you know, explaining, why are the Greek gods in America? It's that, well, the center of Western civilization was Greece, and then slowly it moved, and now the pinnacle of Western civilization is America. So that's why it's here. And so that came up. And so like that reads differently today than it did in 2005. Well, probably to a certain degree, but so 2005 was when Lightning Thief came out. And just to answer your question, 2001 was when American Gods was published first.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So,
but you're right. There is, it does land different. And I think similarly to like the boarding schools, that's something that is largely foreign concept to American audiences. So that's why like Harry Potter is really intriguing to people and kind of a sense of like mystical or foreignness that like, oh, you go and you live at a school and that's where you eat and sleep and do everything. And you're away from your families until the holidays. That's something that we don't, there's, that's interesting. Yeah. That from your end, that not having summer camps, that kind of has, I think, that same sort of mystique or sense of adventure, that you might not have by a native audience.
Yeah. So that's a really good parallel. So the summer camps is our boarding school equivalent. We were talking about, you know, thinking about this as a novel. I would say that it has a really strong identity as a novel beyond the little things we've mentioned, which is it started off a whole kind of subgenre itself, whether or not it was influenced by American Gods or not. I don't think that matters because other people have reimagined these gods before that. And in terms of middle grade and YA children's books, it's become a whole sort of series of books which have the Norse gods and the Egyptian gods. Rick Riordan has done some himself, and I think there's a whole kind of licensing process where you can sort of come up with another mythology.
He has a Rick Riordan Presents like imprint, sub imprint that he like selects. Yeah, people that are authors from different cultures writing about myths, kind of reimagined in contemporary settings. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe that's his answer, because obviously he was writing this in the early 2000s and, you know, me saying, well, what about the Greeks? Maybe that's in a way him sort of reflecting on that and actually saying, I can see that as your kind of, okay, I better tidy up.
Your corrective.
Check this out a bit. So it's clearly very strong as a novel and great. Well done. And I'm sure it will be a classic for many, many years. So let's move on to the first round of the films. The big decision there was to age up the cast. So I'm trying to think of the name of the young man who played Percy Jackson. It was Logan somebody. He was probably he looked a bit like he was sort of high schooler, you know. Mm-hmm. He was good looking. I'll Google his name in a second.
Yeah, Logan Lerman.
Logan Lerman. I was going to say that and I sounded a bit wrong. But anyway, Logan Lerman plus very beautiful Annabeth. You know, improbably beautiful with her blue eyes. I remember that. And,
yes.
And it was quite a cute Grover. I remember quite liking him.
Yes.
Who's a bit older anyway. But the Percy Jackson in that version quite quickly became very adept at sword fighting. He went from being, it's as though he did the Spider-Man thing within a really, you know, he went from being a sort of being swinging between the buildings in like a scene. And they were also playing up on the sort of romance element a bit with early on. There was also some darker elements in it. So the mother and her relationship with the horrible stepfather was a darker edged thing. Yeah, that's what I remember from it. It didn't have the same charm, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Hi, this is Julia Golding. Are you looking for a way to find a gentle beginning to your life as a fantasy writer? Or maybe you're just wanting to brush up your existing skills, but you don't have time to come to a class. Well, we've devised for you the perfect beginner's course. You can find it on our website. The course is full of exciting chapters for you to take at your own pace, starting with packing your bag and setting out on an adventure. And over the course of the lessons, you'll learn to find a hero, gather allies, and get under your belt all the basic skills you'll need to write yourself your fantasy story. So why not have a look at this today and see if it suits you? and I look forward to meeting you in our chat room, which comes along with the course. So what are you waiting for? Time to pack your bag and get writing.
Yep. Yeah, no, exactly. And that's it. And I rewatched the film in preparation, you know, for this. Like, I've been inundated with Percy Jackson over the past like few weeks, which I think is a good thing, which it's been a fascinating study of going between the book and the film and the television series, which I recommend to anyone to do just in terms of adaptations, interpretations, and reworkings. So it's a Christopher Columbus film. Christopher Columbus directed the first two Harry Potter films, also did Home Alone, and it's done a lot of, you know, kind of like family blockbusters, like big, large scale films that are like family friendly, but that they're, because they're large scale, they are what you call in Hollywood four quadrant films. So the four quadrants are audiences that are over 25 and under 25. And then male and female. So the sweet spot is getting a film that hits all four quadrants. You want males and females over 25 and males and females under 25 equally coming to the film and spending their hard-earned money to put money into your pockets. That's the goal, right, for the studios. And so blockbuster films often are positioned in that way. And so with the aging up, so the reason for aging up Percy Jackson is so that it can get closer to the over 25 audience. You can have more romantic plots to make it something that's more palatable or interesting for adults. But in doing so, there's trade-offs, right? Like you said, so like the tone is there, even the themes, right? So in the books, you might have themes of, you know, like coming of age, personal identity, coming to understand yourself, and what the gods are, you know, the metaphor for gods are used in, what are the gods being used as metaphors for in the books? It uses it in several different ways. In the film, because you only have 2 hours of screen time, you really have to boil it down, distill it to one thing and kind of harp on that. And it really, in the film, it really came across as, to me, the active metaphor was the younger generations of gods rising up to challenge the older generations of gods, which is an older teen, right? So it's the older, you know, older high schoolers that are more rebellious. They're really kind of finding where the boundary is, challenging the authority of their parents. And so that's comes across, that's kind of what's happening here. Well, younger generations of gods and older generations of gods represented for them a teenager struggling against their parents. And like, that's where you get like the conflict and even kind of like a lack of warmth between parents and children in like the god relationships. They're really leaning into the conflict and making it more understandable as the protagonist by having completely aloof, distant parents or parents that are abusive and that you deserve to overthrow them, right? Because the teenagers have to be clearly the antagonist to be able to cheer for them.
Yeah.
In that setting. So there's, yeah, but definitely the aging up affects a number of things. The proficiency of Percy, so that changes kind of him as a character, his attitude, right, as a character, and his relatability. Either way, again, depending on where you are in the audience, and the romance subplots, which is why they also including, you know, Pierce Brosnan as your Charon.
Yeah.
Yep. And so that's to draw in the older audience, right? Have like hire, you know, big name actors that can draw in, and like Pierce Brosnan is James Bond, attracting male and female audience members with that kind of casting. So it's strategic, but like it's an adaptation. They focused on something in particular to make a particular. So it's a retelling. So each adaptation is an interpretation and essentially a retelling for a particular audience, and that's the route that they chose to take.
Yeah. So do you think it makes a good film? Just giving
in terms of like a blockbuster, like a four quadrant blockbuster film, because you have, you know, like rather than focus on personal relationships, you're gonna have the spectacles, right? So they're going to the casino, like that's gonna be one of your big set pieces. You're gonna have, you know, like two or three big set pieces, as is expected, and that's where you're gonna spend your budget on the set, on the CGI, on that. So it was, I remember enjoying it fine when I saw it, when it was, when it came out in 2010, it was just okay. But for what it was, it's kind of like a popcorn, you know, light adventure kind of summer blockbuster film, but not one that really merits rewatching.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And I think that's why Rick Riordan doesn't like it, in that somehow they've lost the heart. So the film, as you said, it was a perfectly watchable film. Not at all bad to watch on a rainy day, go into a cinema, you know, nothing wrong with it from that point of view. Competently put together, the performances are fine. Moves along nicely. As you say, there's some great cameos from all sorts of famous people in it. But I've never thought, oh, I must go back and rewatch that.
Right. Never once. Yeah.
No. And we do have it on DVD downstairs somewhere, I think, still somewhere. But I can't remember anyone asking for it to go be put on again. So, yeah, that. And I think a lot of that is because we don't really care an awful lot about Percy. There's just something not. If you think about Harry Potter, for example, if Harry Potter, by starting him at 11, you start him seeing him as a baby, don't you? There is something almost kind of like we're invested in seeing this child succeed, and the stakes get higher and higher, and it gets worse and worse and worse. If you'd started Harry Potter at, you know, when he was in
17,
the second to last year at Hogwarts, you'd probably think, oh, okay.
Right.
But no, you've seen him as a child, and you've seen how it goes with the being living in the cupboard under the stairs. There is elements of that in the Percy Jackson book, with him failing at the schools and what have you, which they don't have time to do in the film version because they're cramming everything into the, you know, 2 hours or whatever. And so we just end up thinking, oh, okay, demigod finding his way. But we're not invested. So I think it was a good idea for them to have another go at it now as a limited series, or the first series. So what do you think of the Disney adaptation? Do you think the appeal to the audience has changed? I personally think that this has gone the other way. So going back to your four quadrant thing, I think that actually by being more faithful to the book, they've actually lost the potential of an older market. I mean, you might sit and watch it with your kids, but I don't think it quite has the, you know, the people will say, oh, that's for children, which it is. It's right. A series primarily for children.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this is fascinating. So I was trying to think through, like, who is the audience for this? Because yes, you have, you definitely have a younger cast of characters. But at the same time, the tone of the show is adult. So you don't have the kind of crass humor. It's not leaning into the Homer, the humor is more measured and sparse than it is in the book, right? In the book, Percy's kind of is wisecracking a lot, and you have a lot of jokes that a middle grader would make. Those, I was surprised by how few and far between those elements were. This was a very kind of like somber and serious.
Yeah, it's plucked off, isn't it? The palette is quite dark. I was watching it when I was traveling, and several times we couldn't work out if it couldn't see it, because I couldn't work out if settings wrong. So we're in bright hotel rooms or something. Yep. So yep. It is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Needs to be seen with the curtains closed.
So this is where like, I'm interested in talking to children to see what they thought and if they liked it. Because to me, as I was looking at what's happening there with humor being kind of more sparing, it really is getting into the emotional lives of these characters, right? And when the kind of the operating metaphor that it has here is like gods and their offspring is a way to explore and critique parent-child relationships, right? So it's not the like overthrowing the gods, like that part of it, but it's more so they examine all of the different, examine healthy and toxic family relationships and patterns. So that's really the through line. And they do a masterful job of that. Something that didn't even, like you're saying earlier, when an adaptation can add elements and really transcend in some ways what the source material did, that's really what I feel is happening here with the Percy Jackson television series, just Disney Plus series, is that they're honing in on this particular thread, the gods, Greek gods, and the stories of Greek gods and gods of the offspring of gods and interrelationship between these families of gods, right? Because they're all related. So by emphasizing that family relationship and exploring challenges that everyone has in their own family relationships, tensions, misunderstandings, disagreements, love-hate relationships with parents, with cousins, aunts, uncles, siblings, all of that, I think they really honed in on that and lifted up those elements from the book, or even introduced some elements that weren't necessarily there explicit in the book. And in doing so, we're able to craft a particular emotional arc and journey for Percy Jackson, for these other characters, that I thought was masterful, was very, very, very well done.
Yeah, but actually hearing you talk about it, though, does make me wonder. I think they've missed a trick in actually being in love enough with the world of Greek gods. I'm thinking, going back to Harry Potter, which I keep thinking of, because there is an element of Harry, Ron, and Hermione with Annabeth, Percy, and... I mean, but there is a moment quite early on in the first Harry Potter film where he says something like, oh, I love magic. I just love magic. He's looking around Hogwarts and it's just... And I wondered... Obviously, you know, there's the downside is poor old Percy is actually starting his journey being traumatized because he sees his mum dying. So he's starting his world there in grief, which is difficult to actually then say, hey, we're all superheroes. But I wondered if an element of whether the actual magic of being a demigod is sufficiently enjoyed. I was also I wasn't sure about some of the CGI choices. My biggest problem was with the Chiron in this one, who I thought that the proportion of man to horse looked really wrong. So I started worrying about, okay, where's your stomach? You know, it looks like man stuck on top of the horse. I really think they could have done a better job of the proportions. There have been other centaurs who have been done better, and there was just something really bad about that. And I found it really off-putting. Some of the CGI was a bit iffy. I know it's probably not got the same kind of budget as a film would do, but maybe one of the reasons for so many dark scenes is it's cheaper to animate monsters coming out of the dark than complicated monsters against the background.
Yeah.
I felt at times that the budget felt a bit straightened and not quite what we now get used to. What I really liked about this version, and I did watch it all the way through and enjoy it, and I would watch another series. So, I mean, it succeeded from that point of view, is I really did like Percy. He was convincingly young, his voice slightly on that edge of being broken.
Broken, yep.
Vulnerable. He had this vulnerability about
it.
So when Annabeth is the sort of first prefiguring of Annabeth sort of scheming is how she uses him in the capture the flag game. And him wandering around being, oh, I'm told to go and stand over here now, am I? You know, that feeling of being the child who doesn't understand what's going on around you was, I felt, really well evoked. And that felt very relatable. And I thought he was splendid. I thought Annabeth was also, she was given a limited number of things to do, but she was fine. Absolutely fine. I also particularly like Grover.
Yeah. Very strong. And this is one of the amazing difference, I think, between today and say 30, 40 years ago, is like the caliber of child actors.
This
is like it's a very, very good. So like there wasn't really, I can't even really remember moments where acting took me out of the story. Yeah, these young actors were so good and so invested in these like emotionally weighty roles, again, like exploring these themes of trauma, overcoming family-based trauma, that like, I'm just, yeah, very, very, very impressed, and thought that they definitely added to the story, making it convincing that like, yes, these are people who, like you said, like vulnerable, like the vulnerability just like shone through, and like the regret and sadness and like the dilemmas that they're having to go through, that it was really, it was very real and grounded. And I don't know, again, like, I don't know if that they did such a good job of following the script, if that was the script didn't have within it more of a sense of the wonder that you said. So you don't really have as much, you have moments where they're just like, yeah, this is fun, and kind of playing a playful experience with having godlike powers. But that's really kind of subdued and here in this, whereas with the book, right, it was, you have this exuberant voice, this character, this first person who is, you know, every time something happening to talk about how cool it is and how awesome or great, and is constantly pointing out the wonder. So that's one of the things that you're right, I think, to observe that here, by focusing on those really heavy emotional, relational themes, that sometimes you miss a little bit of the sense of like wonder, that maybe people in that age would be more likely to experience and notice, as kind of highlighted in the Harry Potter, books and the adaptations there.
So we're talking about the success of adaptations. Would you say that the TV series was a better adaptation than the film?
Yeah. Yes, for what they're trying to, I think it is. I think it's one like I would later rewatch the Percy Jackson television, the Disney Plus series, because yeah, there are a number of themes, the themes that they're experiencing, or that that they're exploring and expressing, touching on such fundamental elements of, you know, like family relationships, trauma, trauma response, dealing with toxic relationships, as well as like ideas of meaning. So they're able to take questions about, you know, like, what does something mean? Like with, you know, talking about the St. Louis Arch, for example, you know, like, is this really a shrine to Athena? It's like, well, if somebody imbues it with that, or if somebody approaches it in this way, yes, it can be imbued. So it's they're dealing with a number of different topics that are larger, and that like Greek mythology deals with writ large, but. It's it doesn't really harp on like, this person is categorically good, this person is categorically bad, right? You show how with how that deals with Poseidon, with Percy's father, spoiler alert for people who didn't understand already, but I hope that wasn't too much respect. But like his mother, right? You see like the goods, the struggles, that she isn't just qualitatively an incredible parent. She has things that she's working through and that has done wrong. And she has to own up to that. Same thing with the father. He's far more relatable than the film version, or even I think in the book, perhaps. Like you have, I think there's a level of, there's a depth, there's an emotional depth and kind of an ambiguity that allows, I think, for a richer engagement with the text and like those ideas as a being a piece to explore family relationships. So I think, In that sense, that it makes you think and interested to revisit it and think about those ideas long after I watched it, then if that's the rubric that we're using, then yes, I would say it was a very successful adaptation.
Yeah, you raised the question in our sort of notes for this discussion about if you see any links between Tolkien and Percy Jackson, other than Percy Jackson sounding a bit like Peter Jackson. No, not that. What I was thinking actually is a link, is a sort of basis of fantasy, because what Rick Riordan has done is, moving aside from live religious discussions, you know, you don't want to sort of have a, you know, have Jesus and God and things being involved, because that's kind of people's real living faith that you'd be using as a structure. By moving it sideways to imagining a sort of a modern pantheon for America, and then reinterpreting the gods and the creatures within that, within an American context, you sort of give this mythology background that is extendable, that you can imagine, you can tell stories within. So that's the great kind, that's a really strong fantasy world, because it has imaginative extensions. And if you think about what Tolkien was doing, he invented his own pantheon of gods, which he put on top of a sort of prehistory for Britain, with his Valar and the Eanor and the music, which is, you can see the roots of that in other mythologies like the Norse gods and others, but he's doing his own version of it and extending that world to such a point, getting beyond the Silmarillion, that you get stories that kind of only very, very lightly touch on his pantheon that he originally thought of. They're there behind it all, but he's moved so far away that he almost can tell a story without mentioning them, hardly at all. So there is a sort of correlation between those two, which I think is worth thinking through. If anyone here is listening and is thinking of creating their own fantasy world, it's how do you deal with your sort of divine element? If you've got one in your story, how do you interpret it? For me, that was a connection. Did you see any other connections? Because you raised the question.
Yeah. And I think your answer was great and a great observation. I was thinking of like more of a crass, practical level with the adaptations, which is, so I'll give the cheap answers you gave. Yeah. So maybe we should reverse that, and you could wait and give that same answer after I give this like really superficial answer. That would be great. So with the films themselves, right? So the film, Sean Bean plays Zeus.
Oh,
right.
Okay. Right.
Right. It's who plays Boromir in the Lord of the Rings films. And then for the Percy Jackson's Disney Plus series, the themes, the musical themes were created by Bear McCreary, who wrote the score and soundtrack for the Rings of Power series. So you can hear, if you watch Rings of Power, you could hear some echoes of some of the themes that are used there in Percy Jackson. But so that's my superficial Tolkien, kind of like secondary, tertiary Tolkien connections to Percy Jackson in adaptation specifically. But I really liked what you said there about, I think one of the reasons why Percy Jackson had, as a series and as a world, like you said, it allows for imaginative extension. I really like that phrase. And I think that's the sign of a really good imaginative world. Because the same thing with like Harry Potter, right? It allows for imaginative extension for people to want to enter into that and want to like tell stories, and that it feels like there's space that you could tell a completely different story. That you're kind of scratching the surface. And that's really what you get with Tolkien, that the world that he created in the Silmarillion, that Lord of the Rings is just scratching the surface as one possible story, as one, you're only following one very small piece of this enormous world that was created. And so I think, with Percy Jackson, you can kind of see that once you're setting it against the backdrop of gods and their relationship and machinations across like an entire country, this like very large, unnecessarily large country, that like the opportunities for stories and storytelling, I think, is there and almost endless. Absolutely agree with you.
Thank you. So just to wind this up, do we have a Greek mythology related fantasy tip? Because we always have some kind of fantasy tip at the end. What's yours?
So I went this past summer, listened to both the Iliad and the Odyssey narrated. Phenomenal jobs by Alfred Molina narrated the Iliad. If you're a superhero fan, if you're a Shakespearean fan, he is wonderful. He's British. If you're a superhero fan, He's Dr. Octopus in Spider-Man 2.
Yeah.
But he's like, he's and in No Way Home, reprising his role. Phenomenal. But he does a tremendous job. So he's the classically trained actor, Guild School for acting. It's like just phenomenal. So he does the narrating for the Iliad. And the Odyssey, again, another superficial Tolkien connection, is narrated by Sir Ian McKellen.
Ah.
You can get a version of that that is wonderfully done. And so if you're looking, and just like as I was, you know, listening to that, just again, these imaginative worlds, imaginative extensions, just being fully immersed in these worlds, and kind of like following the flow of the stories and Homer's storytelling, that really just kind of renewed my love for the classics and Greek literature in particular. And I actually, the reason I went through a re-listen, reread was after reading a few different biographies of C.S. Lewis and his kind of regular, you know, his love for Greek literature and how much that inspired his own writings and fantasy writings and what he's doing in Narnia. So you can kind of see little glimpses and peaks of different things and how that intersects. And that was just delightful. So my recommendation is an old one. You might've heard of it. It's the Iliad and the Odyssey by one Homer, one.
Also
yeah. Yes. Right.
But
exactly. But those, the audio versions are great.
That links quite well to my recommendation, which is as we are, interested in the Inklings, you mentioned C.S. Lewis. If, dear reader out there, you haven't yet read C.S. Lewis's Until We Have Faces, you don't really understand and know C.S. Lewis. It is probably his best adult novel by quite a long way. It is a reimagining of the Psyche myth, but it is an unusual female heroine, completely different, very complex than anything you might expect him to write. So I would say go away and read that, because it is a huge surprise when you do. I bet if someone gave it to you without his name on the front, it would be one of the last people you imagine who'd written that novel. It's so surprising. Okay, so just for a little bit of fun, where do you think, in our best places in all fantasy worlds, where do you think it's the best place to be a god? But we're going to narrow it down in honor of Poseidon. Where do you think it's the best place to be a water god in all the fantasy worlds, with your trident out over water? And
yeah, right. See, I would love, I think, and this is, again, a bias towards C.S. Lewis, that Narnia, I would love to explore but being a water god in Narnia was like, because we see, you know, you have naiads, dryads, yeah, you have different
Father
characters, but you don't see
some river god comes at some point in Prince of Castle.
No, no, exactly. Right. Yeah, no, exactly. And so yeah. I think with, Voyage of the Dawn Treader, you're in the water. And so, and like you see, right, the underwater, like toward at the very end, you know, this kind of like underwater world that they just like hint at and give you kind of a longing, and CSO gives you like instills a longing for this like underwater world that you only glimpse barely and then leave behind. But just like, just the imaginative with Narnia's kind of Greek philosophical and mythological kind of underpinnings and intermixings, I think that's it would be fun to explore. I would like to see what the Poseidon or the Poseidon equivalent would be doing in Narnia. It's something that's completely just like attached to the sea and the world of water. So how about you, Julia?
I'm going to go slightly different. Because, you know, I was thinking Aquaman, Avatar. No. I was thinking actually one really interesting imaginings of a river god is Ben Aronovich's Rivers of London, which is the first of a series of novels set in a sort of slightly skewed London, where the river gods like Father Thames and the other rivers that are now mainly lost in London are all personified in that Greek myth way. And I think that's a really fun thing to think of. So a lot of those are taken. So I might try and be another river that's not yet been given, I don't know, the Tweed or the River Severn or something. I'll choose another river and have a visit that world as this sort of personified god, goddess. I think that's quite an interesting way of putting a fantasy frame around natural things. So that's my choice. Ben Aronovich, The Rivers of London. Jacob, thank you so much for talking about Percy Jackson with us. And we look forward to Disney getting around to making a second series, because I think we'd both watch it, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
So goodbye from us.
Thanks for listening to Mythmakers Podcast, brought to you by the Oxford Centre for Fantasy. Visit oxfordcentrefantasy.org to join in the fun. Find out about our online courses, in-person stays in Oxford, plus visit our shop for great gifts. Tell a friend and subscribe wherever you find your favorite podcasts worldwide.
Hi, this is Julia Golding. Are you looking for a way to find a gentle beginning to your life as a fantasy writer? Or maybe you're just wanting to brush up your existing skills, but you don't have time to come to a class? Well, we've devised for you the perfect beginner's course. You can find it on our website. The course is full of exciting chapters for you to take at your own pace, starting with packing your bag and setting out on an adventure. And over the course of the lessons, you'll learn to find a hero, gather allies, and get under your belt all the basic skills you'll need to write yourself your fantasy story. So why not have a look at this today and see if it suits you? And I look forward to meeting you in our chat room, which comes along with the course. So what are you waiting for? Time to pack your bag and get writing.